Good morning, everyone. I just want to welcome everybody and thank you for joining our latest edition of the State of the Economy call. Before we get into the agenda, I just really quickly, on behalf of all of us here at Godsey and Gibb, we just wanted to reach out to our clients in hurricane-affected areas and let you know that we're thinking about you, we're sending thoughts and prayers your way. I know the devastation from Helene was great, and very few of us don't know somebody that was impacted. So please know that all of the staff here has you in their thoughts and prayers. And for you people in Florida who are unfortunately now facing Hurricane Milton, we pray for your safety. And if there's anything that we can do for you, please don't hesitate to let us know. So with that, I will roll to our agenda. I'm going to share my screen. We will get started. I will warn you, I have fall allergies, so hopefully I won't cough all the way through. Anyway, I wanted to make a few comments as we roll into the agenda, but when I was preparing the slides for this call and I think back of all the things that have happened over the last several months, it's sort of amazing what the economy has done and the resiliency in the economy and the resiliency in the financial markets. We've seen escalating global tensions, particularly in the Middle East. We had the sitting president end his reelection campaign and the vice president step in to his slot. We've had two assassination attempts on the Republican candidate, and we've had the Fed step in and begin to normalize interest rates. And despite all of that, the economy continues to perform well. The labor market is holding up. The consumer is holding up. And as I said, the financial markets had a very strong first three quarters of the year and certainly a strong third quarter. So I think that raises in our minds, you know, where do we go from here? And that's really where we're going to focus this call today, is what happens now. Before I get into that, I'll just make a couple of comments on the election. I know we're about 27 days away from the start of the election day, and with any luck, we're no more than 28 days away from knowing the results. But in the meantime, we've got, you know, about a month. There's no doubt this is going to be a close election. And we've talked about in the past that, you know, the 2016 election, about 77,000 people across three states determined the election. In 2020, it was about 65,000 people. I wouldn't be surprised to see those numbers even tighter this time around. And so what we expect is there'll be some shifting momentum here and there over the next 4 weeks. I suppose there's the potential for an October surprise, but I feel like we've had October surprises since January. But I wouldn't rule them out. But from a market perspective, what that really means is volatility in the equity market. As we've talked about, the equity markets don't like uncertainty. So we could see some volatility to the downside, particularly as we work through the next couple of weeks. There's clearly big policy differences between the two major party candidates on things like trade, foreign policy, taxes, the budget, regulation, immigration, any number of things. But I think the key for the post-election time period and into the next administration is going to be the makeup of Congress, because that'll really tell us how much of anybody's policy can be implemented. And our best guess is we are a 50-50 nation. We may see one or both houses of Congress flip to the other party, but it's not very likely that we'll see a significant majority in either house that would support either candidate being able to do a whole lot. But having said that, I do think when we look into 2025, no matter who wins the White House, no matter who's in charge of Congress, they're going to have a lot of important things that have to get done. One, the appropriation bills that have been pushed out into January, so there'll be budget discussions going on. Early in next year, there'll be a need to raise the debt ceiling. And then probably the biggest thing for Congress and the new administration to work through is the expiration of the 2017 tax cuts, which expire at the end of 2025. So there's a lot of things that a lot of volatility and a lot of uncertainty, but overall we think that the economy should continue to perform well as we move forward. So with that, I'm going to talk about today's agenda. The main thing we're going to talk about, two kind of topics here. One is, can the Fed engineer a soft landing? And with that, we'll look at some areas of the economy that have already gone through a recession or are maybe experiencing weakness now. We'll talk a little bit about the Fed's fighting of inflation and protecting the labor market and how that might impact the ability for them to move and preserve a soft landing. And then, you know, ending that section with the outlook for growth. Just real quick, a soft landing, we're basically saying, can the Fed get inflation back to its target, keep the labor market strong, and get rates back to a more neutral level without creating a recession? Our base case is that they can do that, and we'll talk about some of the reasons why as we go through that. The second section focuses on both the equity and the interest rate markets, a little bit of what's been happening lately and some of the positive things we're seeing in terms of breadth in the equity market and our outlook for rates and the path for rates. So that'll kind of be that second section. Time permitting, we'll address any questions you have at the end of my prepared remarks. And if you have a question throughout the presentation, please use the chat function on Zoom and you can input your question there. If we don't get to your question, we will absolutely follow up afterwards. And if you have any questions after the call that you don't submit while we're on the line, just reach out to your wealth management advisor and we'll make sure we get answers to any of your questions. So as I just said, you know, a soft landing is a cyclical slowdown that doesn't lead to a recession. And the Fed, after being so aggressive in raising rates, is trying to get rates to a more neutral level without a recession occurring. And the key is that there are some weak areas of the market that they'd like to see a reacceleration, housing and manufacturing in particular. They still have some work to do on inflation. And more importantly, they want to make sure the labor market stays strong. And a neutral policy rate, just to kind of define that as we go through, that's really a rate that doesn't accelerate growth and it doesn't restrict growth. So it's sort of the Goldilocks in the middle. Very hard to predict what that level looks like, but we'll know it when we get there. A soft landing is something that's not very easy to do, but this time, based on what's been going on, we think that is a base case, it's a reasonable expectation. And so now I'll kind of walk through the slides and why we think that soft landing is possible. So starting with the housing market, we've seen that interest rates have significantly impacted activity in the housing market. But there's also been a supply and demand imbalance in the housing market really going back to COVID. So there's been a twofold problem of late. On the left-hand side of the page, you can see the 30-year mortgage rate, and this goes back to early 2000. On average, over that time period, it's been right just above 5%. Currently, it's just over 6%, and certainly down from the peak that we saw over the last couple of years. We got close to 8%, but didn't quite get there. On the right-hand side of the page is existing home sales, and this is monthly data, but it's expressed as an annualized number. So if you look where we are currently, just under 4 million homes have been sold on an annualized basis. And, you know, to put that in context, if you look back at the housing crisis in 2008 and 2010, while we're not as low as we were at the worst of that time period, we're close to where housing activity was at that time. So it's definitely a significant decline in activity in the housing sector. And it's really twofold. There is not a lot of supply, and that's driven by higher interest rates. One, interest rates are too high to make houses affordable for new buyers. And the other side of that is, if you're sitting in an existing home, even if you're thinking about selling, you may not want to sell your home that has a 3% mortgage to buy a home with a 7 or 7.5% mortgage. So we've described that as homeowners being locked in. And so the locked-in homeowner has kept supply relatively low. And what this has done that's different this time is normally when activity slows down, you would expect prices to slow down or to come down, but they haven't. We've actually seen prices continue to rise. So we have high mortgage rates and high prices and not a lot of supply. And that's really been a strain on the housing market and certainly impacted housing affordability, especially for younger people and first-time home buyers. The second piece of that on page 4 is if you look at new homes. So we know there are not a lot of existing homes being put out on the market, but we're also seeing a slowdown in building activity. So on the left-hand side of the page is the National Association of Home Builders Sentiment Index. There's really about 3 components of this survey of home builders, and it asks them about their current outlook for new home sales. It asks about their outlook for sales over the next 6 months, and then it asks about what kind of traffic they're seeing from prospective home buyers. And those 3 components make up this overall index. And a reading above 50, you would consider that home builders are confident about the future outlook for their industry, and you would expect that to correspond with more building. A reading below 50 is the opposite, more uncertainty, less confidence in the future, and lower activity. We're currently at about 41. It's ticked up a little bit, but you know, it shows there's not a lot of confidence in home builders. We have seen a little bit of an improvement in their outlook for the next 6 months, and that's really driven by the expectation that interest rates come down. But traffic currently and prospect traffic remain relatively low, so we're in the early stages there. On the right-hand side of the page are U.S. housing starts. So this is building of new homes, and a housing start is when construction begins on a new home. And this is also an annualized rate. So we're at about 1.3 million new homes being built on an annual basis. But that number has come down pretty significantly over the last couple of years. And again, this is very much correlated with high interest rates. Buyers are less willing to buy because interest rates are high. And home builders are less willing to build spec homes because their cost of capital is higher with higher interest rates. So this is an area that's been relatively weak, the housing sector as a whole, but as the Fed begins to lower rates, we could see activity pick up. And so this is something that the Fed can impact in terms of taking a sector that's weak, returning it to positive activity, and minimizing the risk of a recession. The other area that has been weak and technically in a recession is the manufacturing sector. So on page 5, we've got the Institute for Supply Management, or ISM, Manufacturing Index. And this is all U.S.-based. And it's a survey of manufacturers across 13 different sectors of the market. So it's pretty broad-based. This is a diffusion index. So what that means is a reading above 50 indicates that the manufacturing sector is expanding. And the higher the number, the faster the pace of that expansion. A reading below 50 indicates that manufacturing is contracting, and the lower the number indicates the pace of that contraction. You can see on this chart, there are gray bars that indicate prior recessions. Typically, when the ISM index falls to around 42, that tends to be correlated with a broad economic recession. But you can see throughout time, it's not unusual for the manufacturing sector to be in recession, but for it not to bleed over to the broader economy. So again, this is an area where interest rates has hurt activity, but if the Fed can begin to normalize rates, we can get the manufacturing sector improving. Part of what we're seeing from the data coming out of this survey and the comments from these companies is just there's too much uncertainty about client orders. There's too much uncertainty about interest rates, and they're really not willing to step up and spend a lot of money ahead of potentially lower rates in the future. So manufacturing is a small part of our economy. We are a consumer-based economy. But the manufacturing sector, as you can see, it's very well correlated with broader economic growth. And it's also correlated pretty well with corporate earnings and profitability. So it's an important sector to watch, even though it doesn't drive our overall economy completely. So with both of these two sectors having been relatively weak, despite that, consumer activity has still been strong, and that's why we're continuing to see positive growth. But the Fed, in its quest for a soft landing, would like to get these two sectors moving in the right direction before there's any additional weakness in the other areas of the market. So on the next few pages, we'll kind of shift to talking more specifically about the Fed and its dual mandate. So we know the Fed is looking for price stability and full employment, so a stable labor market. And they would like to normalize rates to have those two things occur. So we'll start with inflation on page 6. So we've seen a pretty significant improvement on inflation over the last several years as the Fed tightened policy. So you've got a couple of components of the core consumer price index on here, the dark green line being core goods, and that's come down dramatically from its peak. And we're actually seeing year-over-year declines in core inflation at this point. The other two series, while below their peaks, have been somewhat sticky at higher levels. So you've got core services, which excludes housing. Again, that's down, but still above 4% on a year-over-year basis. And then you've got the shelter component, which again has come down from its peak, but is still probably too high. These are the components that the Fed is really focusing on right now, the core services and the shelter areas. But if you look at CPI overall, we'll get a new read later this week, but as of last month, consumer prices were up about 2.5% year over year, and the Fed's preferred measure, which is the core PCE, is up about 2.7% year over year. So getting a lot closer to that 2% target that the Fed wants, but these components are still worth watching. And particularly on shelter, we just talked about the issues in the housing market. Lower rates, if it helps the housing market, may help to bring, and we get more supply into the housing market, we may see that start to ease. The one area that has been relatively strong over the last several years is the labor market. We're more recently seeing some small cracks here. It's still the case that the labor market is strong, but it's, again, the Fed has been so focused on inflation, and now with a little bit of weakening in the housing market, they're looking at that area as well. And Fed Chair Powell, in his comments after their meetings in early September, pointed out that now they're laser focused on inflation, but now their focus is on making sure that the labor market doesn't weaken materially from here. Now, the Fed does expect to see a little bit of weakness in the labor market, but not a significant amount. So on page 7, on the left-hand side of the page, you've got the unemployment rate. The last read we got was at 4.1%, so still historically quite low, but it's been moving higher pretty steadily from the about 3.5% that we saw last year. So still not a problem, but moving in that direction. On the right-hand side of the page is what we call the underemployment rate, and that really includes, it's people who are employed but maybe discouraged workers. If you're working part-time but you wanted to be working full-time, maybe you're working at a job that's below your skill level or where you'd like to be. So you're counted as employed, but you're not necessarily where you want to be. The underemployment rate is really good at turns in the labor market and the health of the labor market, because you tend to see people don't generally go from I'm fully employed, I'm unemployed, and I'm never coming back into the market. What you tend to see is maybe you lose your job and you take something lesser until the labor market improves. So the underemployment rate tends to lead the broader unemployment rate. So far, again, they're both a little bit off of their lows, but not at problematic levels. Another way of looking at the labor market, which is a data series we really like on page 8, is unemployment claims. So this is applications for unemployment insurance. And one of the benefits of this series is it's weekly data. The revisions come very quickly, unlike some data series that are revised once a year, like the non-farm payrolls. This, we get very quick revisions. And it comes from actual applications versus a lot of our economic data comes from surveys. And while the surveys do a good job, you know, it's not as good as somebody walked into the office and filled out an application for unemployment insurance. So I had to split this into two charts because the increase in unemployment claims during the first 2 months of the COVID pandemic really just skew the scaling on these charts. So I took those 2 months out and split it into two. But I think there's a lot we can learn from both of these charts. So on the left-hand side, you have the four-week moving average. So we do that to smooth the week-to-week changes. But this is the initial jobless claim, so applications for unemployment insurance going back to 1980. We have marked in there when there are recessions. And what you can see is that unemployment claims tend to start rising a little bit ahead of a recession, and they continue to rise throughout the recession. And it's really not until growth starts to turn that you see claims come back down. If you look on the right-hand side of the page, picking up just after the initial hit from the pandemic, you can see claims came down from, you know, well over or 900,000 on a weekly basis down to where we've been really since early 2022, which is a range of about 200,000 to 250,000. This data is really not showing much weakness or any weakness in the labor market at all. And if you compare that 200,000 to the periods we see in the past, we're not seeing significant job layoffs. We're not seeing people lose their jobs or leave their jobs yet. But what this tells us is that the labor market, while it has some cracks, it's still very strong. It can still support consumer spending, and it supports that soft landing. So when you take all the things we've talked about, the sectors of the economy that are weaker or in recession, the things that the Fed is focused on, the labor market still being strong, this is what's leading the Fed to be able to adjust policy and hopefully get that soft landing. On page 9, we have the normalization of monetary policy. On the left-hand side is the Fed funds rate. You can see the more lime green lines are the Federal Reserve's own forecast for changes in rates going forward. So we had a 50 basis point cut in the Fed funds rate in mid-September. So that took the range to 4.75 to 4.5. The Fed is forecasting that they will cut rates 2 more times this year for a total of 50 basis points more, or 100 basis points total. And then this chart actually only goes through mid-2025, cutting rates so that we exit 2025 with a Fed funds rate around 3 to 3.25%. And if you push that out into 2026, the Fed is looking to end with a funds rate of around 2.75 to 3%. And then their forecast, which goes through 2027, has it staying in that range. So that's kind of an expectation of what the Fed thinks a neutral rate might be. So 2.75 to 3%. On the right-hand side of the page is the market's expectation for the Fed. This is based on pricing in the Fed funds futures market. So the green bars that you see are the expected rate number of rate cuts, and each rate cut is a 25 basis point increment. So if you see two rate cuts expected, that means a total of 50 basis points. And then the lime green line is the implied funds rate when you get to, based on those rate cuts. So at this point, which was actually a week ago, the market was looking for somewhere between 7 and 8 rate cuts by mid-2026 and a terminal rate of about 2.75. So not dissimilar from what the Fed itself is forecasting. But I would point out that this data, the market-based data, is very volatile based on the most recent information that we see. You know, if you remember at the beginning of this year, they were looking for, I think, 6 rate cuts this year. So it tends to be very volatile. And in fact, last week we had better than expected labor market data, and that impacted these numbers. And the market is now looking for more like 7 rate cuts and a terminal value of around 3%. So how do all of these things tie into our outlook for growth? Well, let's look on page 10. GDP growth, the previous quarter and the second quarter, the dark green bars are actual growth and the gray bars are forecasted growth. And these particular forecasts come from Strategus, which we partner with them for some of our macroeconomic data and information. So the one thing I would point out is the second quarter growth of 3%, that's now a final number. When we put this chart together, it was still preliminary. But if you look going from the third quarter through the end of 2025, what you see is moderate growth below the 2% long-term trend, but still positive. Where we might differ from Strategus on this is, I think the path of growth in that 1.5 to 2% range is highly likely, but it's not likely that we're going to have symmetric growth quarter after quarter. You know, 1.5% every quarter for the next 6 quarters is probably not likely. What we might see is a quarter that's weaker than that, followed by a catch up in the next quarter. So we would expect growth overall to be in this range, but perhaps a little bit more volatility quarter to quarter. So this chart, as an ending point for this economic piece of it, is, you know, because interest rates can impact the areas of the market that are weak, because the labor market is still strong, the Fed can lower rates and engineer a soft landing without recession. There's still some risk of recession, but it's relatively low. And I would say the key to all of that is the pace of lowering rates. So as long as inflation continues to move towards the 2% target, they can move at the pace that they've laid out. But if they move too fast and inflation reaccelerates, that's going to raise recession risk. If they move too slow and the labor market starts to weaken more materially than we're seeing or than they expect, then that would raise risks for the market. And then there's always the risk, the positive surprise, that they get rates down and growth reaccelerates more than we think, and we have an upside surprise, not just a soft landing, but a growth reacceleration. But the base case is positive growth, but perhaps a little bit below trend. So with that, I'm going to move to talking a little bit about what's been going on in the equity market first. And, you know, we've talked a lot for the better part of the last 2 years about the impact that the concentration of very large names has had in the indexes, particularly the S&P 500. The so-called Magnificent Seven, which is Microsoft, Nvidia, Google, Apple, Meta, Broadcom, and Amazon, make up somewhere between 25 and 30% of the index. So good or bad, the returns on those companies are really driving the return of the S&P 500. And through the first half of this year, they were responsible for 75% of the return of the S&P 500. So the S&P was up 15% in the first half, and they accounted for 10 percentage points of that return. The other 493, while contributing a little bit to the return, really were not a factor. I do want to point out, it's difficult when the other companies are not participating, but there is a reason why those seven companies have been driving index returns and their prices going up. It is, you know, they have been generating sales and revenue growth and earnings growth that's higher than most of the rest of the 493. You know, as we've seen the growth in AI and cloud-based technologies, these companies have been experiencing significant growth. And they've really created a little bit of an ecosystem for themselves because they do buy and interact with each other. So as one is growing, you know, if Microsoft is growing, they might be buying chips from Broadcom or somebody else. When Amazon expands, it impacts some of these others. But they've created, you know, a very strong growth profile. So it's not that we're saying that these companies shouldn't be performing well. But what we've been really looking for and finally saw in the third quarter is that all of the other companies that have been working really hard to get through this inflationary period and improve their profit margins are now starting to benefit from that work. So what you see here on page 11, on the left-hand side of the page, is the third quarter returns for the S&P sectors. What's nice about that is it's much, much broader than what we've seen over the last 2 years. The S&P was up 5.9%, and most sectors actually outperformed the broader index. Energy was the only sector that was down for the quarter, and that's really driven by lower energy prices. We saw a significant decline in demand for oil, particularly out of China. And that led to lower prices, which impacted the energy sector. You know, the technology sector was modestly positive, but lagged the index for the first time in a very long time. And shifting to the other end of the graph, if you look, the two best performing sectors were utilities and real estate, both very interest rate sensitive sectors. So some of that is a catch up for the underperformance over the last couple of years, and also a recognition that these sectors will benefit from lower rates. When you look on the right-hand side of the page, you can see the same chart, but it's year-to-date through the end of the third quarter. So the S&P was up 22% for the first three quarters of the year. Now, most sectors are still lagging the benchmark, but they are significantly better than they were as we've seen this broadening. Interestingly, the utility sector edged out technology by a hair and is actually the best performing sector year to date. And I mentioned, you know, it's an interest rate sensitive sector. I think there's a couple of things going on with utilities. One, utilities are some of the most capital intensive businesses. So they are constantly building and they have high maintenance costs. So they have more debt than a lot of other industries. And so when interest rates are high, their cost of debt is higher, and that impacts their earnings. Secondly, you know, it's an income-oriented sector, so very high dividends relative to the rest of the market. But when interest rates rise, people may shift from equity risk to bond market to get better yields. As yields start to come down, those dividend yields and utilities get more interesting. So I think that's part of what's been going on. And then the third thing that's often missed is that the growth of cloud-based technologies and the build-out of data centers is really impacting utilities in certain regions. Data centers use a tremendous amount of energy to run. And so on the margin for utilities that are in sectors of the country where data centers are growing, their earnings profile is improving. Now, it's not gonna take them to, you know, a 20% earnings growth profile, but on the margin in a sector that has, let's call it on average, 5 to 7% annual earnings growth, it can push them a couple percent higher than that. So I think all of those things are benefiting the utility sector. Information technology remains strong, and we think that will continue as the build-out and growth of AI and cloud-based continues. And even for those sectors that have underperformed the broader benchmark, you know, we're really pleased to see that they are participating, and even the worst performing sector is up over 8% for the year. So much better breadth and driven by fundamental improvement of all of those companies across the market. When we talk about index concentration and the small group of companies that make up a lot of the S&P 500, one of the ways that we look to see how the rest of the index is performing is to look at an equal weighted index. So instead of weighting each company by its market cap size, you equally weight all 500 companies. And that really gets at how is the, you know, average stock doing relative to the largest companies in the index. So on page 12, there's just a quick look at that. On the left-hand side of the page, that's the 12-month difference, rolling difference between the return of the market cap weighted benchmark and the equal weighted. So when the line is rising, that means the market cap weighted benchmark is outperforming the equal weighted. And when that line is falling, the equal weighted is outperforming the market cap weighted. So more recently, we've seen that gap between the two start to narrow. It's still pretty wide, and we're not surprised, again, given what we've talked about with the technology stocks and how well they've performed and the reasons they've performed well. But it's good, again, to see those differences start to normalize. On the right-hand side of the page, similar story, but you see just year-to-date, the cumulative return of each of those benchmarks. And what you really see is in those late spring to early summer months, the market cap weighted index really shot ahead, while the equal weighted benchmark moved relatively sideways. And that explains a lot of the gap that we're seeing year to date. More recently, you see, while the gap is still there, they both moved pretty similarly over the last several months to close that gap. So, you know, it's a matter of, this helps us understand that we are seeing other companies participate in this rally. And again, I would emphasize they're participating because their earnings prospects and their sales prospects are improving as well. They're not generating 50% annual earnings growth like we're seeing from some of the Magnificent Seven, but they're certainly providing good, strong fundamental performance, and the market is now recognizing that. With that, I'm going to move into the last little section on interest rates, page 13. Here you've got a representation of a portion of the yield curve. This is the spread between the 10-year Treasury yield and the 2-year Treasury yield. Again, looking back over time, this is often used as a proxy for recession risk or an indication of a potential recession. Typically, you would expect that the 10-year Treasury would have a higher yield than the 2-year Treasury because investors would want to be compensated for that longer maturity risk. But when the economy is slowing down, or there's concerns about it slowing down, you actually see a shift where investors want more yield out of shorter maturity debt, and the yield curve gets inverted. So generally what you see here, it does invert before the recessions that are on this chart. In most cases, it has re-inverted or gotten to a more normal shape before the recession starts. And, you know, we've been in an inverted position since 2022, got as bad as a 1% differential in yield. But more recently, as people began to price in the idea that the Fed could begin to lower rates without a recession occurring, we're seeing the yield curve steepening. Now, albeit it's a very small blip there, but we're about 14 basis points where the 10-year yield is above the 2-year yield. So the last two charts I'm going to show you breaks this out, where I'm going to talk about the 2-year and what's driving it, and the 10-year and what we might look for there to kind of close out our outlook for interest rates. So the 2-year Treasury here, this is just the yield over that same time period. Shorter maturity bonds are much more correlated to monetary policy. So when the market believes that the Fed is going to start raising rates, you'll see the 2-year yield move up much more in line with that. And then conversely, when people feel that the Fed needs to cut rates, you'll see that yield come down. And if you look at the right-hand side of the chart, you know, the 2-year went from almost zero up ahead of the Fed raising rates. During that time period, that the Fed was on hold, it held steady in that, call it 4 to 4.5, 4 to 5% range. And then it began to come down as the market was pricing potential Fed rate cuts. Now that we've started that rate cut process, our expectation would be that short yields will continue to come down. If the Fed's forecasts and the market forecasts are right, that we're headed towards, let's call it a 3% funds rate, we would expect the 2-year to be above that funds rate, but you know, somewhere closer to a 3.5% type range. So there is still room for those yields to fall for further. The longer maturity parts of the curve, the 10-year and beyond, tend to be more correlated not just to monetary policy, but the longer term economic outlook. But that's not always the case. And today, we think that the fiscal policy outlook may be more impactful on longer term bonds than is typical in a cycle. And page 15, we can look at that. So the columns on page 15 are interest costs on government debt as a percentage of the federal budget, and that is the left-hand scale. So right now, interest costs on the debt are about 16% of the total federal budget. That's almost as high as we've been going back to 1998. We were a little bit higher. And there's two reasons for that. One, obviously, if interest rates are higher, then the cost of servicing that debt is going to go up. But the other thing is that the debt is going up, and going up rather quickly. We've seen, you know, we're at a $35 trillion plus total debt, and it's moved up pretty rapidly. The line that you see is the yield on the 10-year Treasury. What we're thinking, or what we're seeing here, is that because the debt has grown so much, that the 10-year yield, because the government's going to have to issue more debt over time, that it may not come down as much when the Fed raises rates. It may not move with the economy, but it may move with fiscal policy. And historically, when the interest cost has gotten above about 15% of the federal budget, you start to see some fiscal discipline. We would love to believe that'll happen this time, but we don't know. But in the meantime, I think the higher cost of federal government debt is going to weigh on longer term rates, and investors in longer term bonds are going to require more yield in order to want to buy these bonds that are supporting a larger base of debt. So while the short term yields can come down with the Fed, and long term yields can come down, they may not come down as much as you would typically see in a cycle. And more recently, we've actually seen them move a little bit higher, and we wouldn't be surprised to see the 10-year move a little bit higher over the near term. And I know I often get questions about the debt and the deficit, and it's such a long-term question, and knowing what amount of debt is a tipping point is always difficult to highlight. But what I can tell you is that interest costs are a near-term issue, and that it could lead to higher rates in the back end. So with all of that, I've covered a lot of stuff. I think just to tie it all together, you know, we think that the base case, the likely scenario, is we see moderately slower growth into next year and throughout next year. The Fed can and will continue to lower rates. Question is how fast and how far, and that will really depend on the state of the labor market and the level of inflation, and if we can get those sticky components to come down, particularly shelter. And you know, on the equity market side, we're still seeing good broad-based earnings growth, so that can support the equity market going into next year. And on the rate front, you know, lower rates in the short end, potentially somewhat lower rates in the long end, but we're not looking for dramatically lower interest rates. So there will still be the case that the fixed income market can provide good value, good income, and good diversification in portfolios. So with that, let me look up here. I know I've gone a little bit over in time. I know I see a couple of questions related to the labor market. They're probably a little more in depth than I can go into, considering I've already run over our time. So I will get back to you directly on those questions. And again, if any questions come in, anything that I've covered today that you have questions, please reach out to your wealth management advisor and we'll make sure that we get those questions answered. And with that, again, everybody in the path of Milton, please stay safe. And everybody who's been impacted by the storms of late, again, we're sending you positive thoughts and prayers and hope that the recovery efforts continue. So with that, I will end the call. Thank you all so much for participating.